Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Lawrence Wright. Wright has been a staff writer for The New Yorker for over two decades. Before that, he worked for a variety of publications across the South and Southwest and served as a contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine. Wright is the author of one novel and eight nonfiction books, including The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, which won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, and Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief, which was shortlisted for the National Book Critics Circle Award. In 2006, he premiered his one-man play, My Trip to Al-Qaeda, at the New Yorker Festival. 4 years later, this play was adapted into an HBO documentary film. Wright followed up this play with several others, most notably Camp David, which premiered in 2014. Now, from the 2013-14 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here's Lawrence Wright speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Well, thank you so much for that warm welcome. This is my first time in Portland. Thank you. I live in Austin, and people in Austin are always saying, Portland is like a damp Austin. And you know, they're often compared, and, you know, both cities seem to be yearning to keep it weird. Although the evidence of the poetry reading is that Portland is doing a better job of that. Portland also has a place in Scientology history. And L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, was stationed in the Navy here briefly, and a sub chaser that was manufactured in the shipyards here became under his command, and he took it out for his initial cruise, and just as he got out into the ocean, he believed that he discovered on a sonar a Japanese sub, and so he began sending depth charges down, and this went on for 3 days. He believed he found two Japanese submarines. And finally, other ships were sent, and they never found any submarines. Later, they discovered that they did an investigation, and they found that the evidence of the submarine was a single bubble that came up out of the ground. It may have been from the depth charges. And on that same cruise, he went on down south and took some gunnery practice on some remote islands that turned out to belong to Mexico. And so it was not an auspicious period in his naval career, so I don't think that Portland was his favorite place. Portland was also the scene of a moment that almost brought the Scientology story to an end. In 1985... a young woman named Julie Christofferson Tichborne brought suit against the Church of Scientology, and she wanted her money back. She said that the church had promised that it would increase her intelligence, her creativity, even her eyesight, and none of those things had actually occurred. And she also said that the church misrepresented things about Hubbard's life, that he was a nuclear engineer, for instance. He never graduated from college. And that he had healed himself with these powers that he called Dianetics, and that he was blinded and crippled after the war, and he healed himself. And the evidence was that that never happened. And she was also very disturbed by the fact that people inside the church, when you go into church, oftentimes you have what are called auditing sessions. They're a kind of therapy, and on many occasions these things are recorded. And people confess things as they would in any therapeutic situation. And according to the trial, there were people inside the church that were garnering material that could be used to blackmail people that wanted to defect from the church. Well, Miss Christofferson Tichborne was asking for $30,000 initially to get her money back, and the Portland jury awarded her $39 million. As I said, this was a very difficult moment for the church. It didn't have $39 million. And Scientologists from all over the world came to Portland. More than 15,000 people were down. On my morning walk this morning, I went past the county courthouse in that park in front of it, where they were encamped during May and June of 1985. And it was a rallying point. It was a moment of existential doubt for the church, whether it could survive. And the judge finally ruled a mistrial in the case. And Scientology declared this as a great victory. Eventually, they settled with Julie Christopherson Tichborne for an undisclosed amount. But in Scientology, the word Portland still rings a bell. At that same year, there was another trial going on in Los Angeles by another Scientology defector named Lawrence Wallersheim. And he claimed that he had suffered emotional abuse because of what he called brainwashing by the church. And some of the evidence that was produced in his case, this was before the internet. This is at a time when Scientology's secrets were really secrets. And if you were a Scientologist, you had to pay and go up the ladder till you get to there's a section in Scientology which are called operating thetans. And when you get to attain to the level of OT3, if you were a Scientologist in Los Angeles, you would go to this particular building. They would give you a briefcase that would be locked, and you'd have the key. In some cases, it was chained to your hand. And you would go into another room, and you would lock the door behind you, and you would take the key, and you would open up the briefcase, and inside there, you would read Scientology's creation story. And what Wallersheim and every other person read that day was, whoever got to that level, 75 million years ago, there was a galactic overlord named Xenu. And he lived in a galaxy. It was very much like the place that America was in 1950s and 60s. People dressed the same way. They rode in cars and trains and buses and suffered similar problems. For instance, overpopulation, a real problem in the Galactic Confederacy. So Xenu and his evil cohort, mainly psychiatrists, brought in a lot of thetans, they were called, ostensibly for tax audits. So it really was a lot like contemporary life. And they were frozen with glycol injections to the heart. Then they were loaded into boxes and packed into space planes that looked like DC-8s and flown to the prison planet called Tegeac, which is Earth. And they were dropped into volcanoes and then exploded with thermonuclear bombs. But thetans are immortal. So their disembodied spirits floated out of the volcanic cones, where they were captured with electronic nets and reeled in, and then placed like an audience in front of a 3D screen, where for 36 days they were shown images of God, the devil, the modern England, all the things that we think of as real life, and they were called R6 implants. So these thetans are the immortal souls of individuals that have been dead for 75 million years, and they attach themselves to living people because they have no free will of their own. There can be millions of them clustered inside you. In that form, they're called body thetans. And they bring with them all the neuroses and fears and so on that you have in your life. And part of your object in Scientology is to expel those body thetans. The mission of Scientology is to enlighten people about their eternal existence and save them from the endless cycle of self-destruction that always comes with life on Earth. Now, what I've just told you is a religious idea. It doesn't matter if you think it's a great revelation or if you think it's a load of science fiction baloney. The only organization that matters in this determination is the IRS. And in 1993, the IRS determined that the Church of Scientology was just as much a religion as the Southern Baptist or the Christian Science or any mainstream denomination. So the question is not really, is Scientology a religion or not? Instead, I'd like to address two related questions. Where do new religious ideas come from? And why would anybody believe them? Now, in the vast marketplace of beliefs, there must be a kind of romance between the prophet and his believers, a seduction that leads recruits to the spiritual marriage that we call religious conversion. The person who makes a religion, one that has proved as durable and appealing as Scientology, now nearly 60 years old, in some way immortalizes his imagination. It lives on in the minds of people who believe in him. I've spent much of my professional life writing about people who are propelled by religious ideas. I've seen the beauty of such beliefs. I've seen the absurdity, the transformative power, and the danger. My first book was about the Amish. The book just before this one was about Al-Qaeda, which is a function of radical Islam. It may seem to you that the Amish and Al-Qaeda have nothing in common, but they're both totalistic environments that spring from very fundamentalist beliefs and exercise near total control over people's lives, one for good and another for ill, you might say. Religions typically derive from revelations of one sort or another. In 500 BC, Prince Siddhartha sat under the Bodhi tree and went into a trance and became enlightened. He became the Buddha. In Arabia, in 610 AD, an illiterate merchant named Muhammad went into a cave to pray, and there he found the angel Gabriel, who instructed him to recite the verses that became the Quran. In 1823, a teenage Joseph Smith in upstate New York was greeted by the angel Moroni, who handed him a couple of golden plates, which he was able to read, to decipher with a pair of rocks that he called seeing stones. Thus, he was able to read the Book of Mormon. I'm talking about the religion, not the musical. Perhaps these are all revelations from God, in which case I do wish you'd get his story straight. Or else, they are hallucinations, frauds, or products of a diseased imagination. I think in the case of L. Ron Hubbard, we see all three of these factors at work. Hubbard was born in Tilden, Nebraska in 1911, spent a lot of his boyhood in the American West. He says that one of his mentors as a young man was a Blackfoot medicine man named Old Tom Madfeathers. As a young man, he went to New York and wrote for the pulp magazines. They're called pulp magazines because of the cheap paper stock they were printed on. And he wrote westerns, adventure stories, detective stories, but his real métier was science fiction. And he became a part of a crowd with some of the most notable science fiction writers we've ever produced, Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov. And even for those stellar personalities, the pay when you were writing for the pulps was a penny a word. And even during the 30s and 40s, that didn't go very far. And if you wanted to make a living as a writer, you had to write a lot of words. So Hubbard was a master at this. The church says that he wrote 100,000 words a month. He would roll in butcher paper into his IBM typewriter and type so fast, it was a physical act. He would perspire and then rip out the story, send it off, and roll in the next sheet of butcher paper. This training has led him to, you know, all you writers in the audience, actually holds the Guinness Book of World Records for the number of titles published, more than 1,000. So hats off to a very productive individual. It's certainly evidence of a fevered imagination, if not exactly a diseased one. On New Year's Day in 1938, Hubbard had a revelation while he was undergoing a dental operation with gas anesthetic. He wrote, "While under the influence, my heart must have stopped beating. It was like sliding helter-skelter down into a vortex of scarlet, and it was knowing that dying was, that one was dying, and the process of dying was far from pleasant." As his spirit floated out of the dental chair, rose up, he saw a huge gate in the distance and floated through the gate, and there was a table spread out with all the answers to life's questions. Who are we? Where did we come from? Why were we created? And Hubbard's spirit eagerly absorbed these answers. But suddenly, he heard a voice crying, "He's not ready." And he felt himself pulled back into the dental chair. And then he woke up and he turned to the nurse and said, "I was dead, wasn't I?" Out of this experience, he wrote a book called Excalibur. It's never actually been published. Hubbard said that the first 6 people who read it went insane. The last person was a reader for a New York publisher who brought the manuscript back to and set it on his editor's desk and jumped out the window. Too dangerous to read. Hubbard served in the Navy, as I said. And his legend is that after the war, he was blinded and crippled, and that medicine wasn't able to help him. So he had to heal himself. He learned how to heal himself through a process that he called Dianetics. Now, I got Hubbard's military and medical records, and he was never injured in the war. He did have ulcers and conjunctivitis. That's not to say that he wasn't wounded. He wrote a letter to the VA in 1947. "My last physician informed me that it might be very helpful if I were to be examined and perhaps treated psychiatrically. I avoided out of pride any mental examinations, hoping that time would balance a mind which I had every reason to suppose was seriously affected. Would you please help me?" There's no evidence he ever got that treatment. I've had many mental health professionals offer their armchair diagnosis of Hubbard's mental state. He was a malignant narcissist. He was a paranoid schizophrenic. He was an obsessive compulsive. Personally, I think his mentality defies easy categorization. But one diagnosis I'd like to pause over. Anthropologists sometimes call schizophrenia the shaman disease. In Aboriginal societies, such as the Blackfoot Indians, where you have medicine men, or you might have voodoo doctors, the shaman is the person who is broken and has to go on a spirit quest to heal himself. And then he returns to his community and heals others in the community. That's the story that Hubbard tells about himself. Now, not too many schizophrenics that get their books on the bestseller list in the New York Times, but Hubbard wrote a book called Dianetics in 1950. In typical fashion, it took him 3 weeks to write a 500-page book. And it dominated the New York Times bestseller list. It really kind of established the category for self-help books that became so popular after World War II. It swept all over America. There were Dianetics clubs everywhere. It was like the hula hoop, which it was sort of contemporaneous with. And there were Dianetics clubs in America, and Hubbard became a very wealthy man and made millions of dollars and lost it all. He even lost the rights to the name Dianetics. This is all in the space of just a couple of years. So he reinvented himself. He decided, he said on many occasions that religion is where the money is. So he decided to start a religion. Now, his recipe for starting a contemporary religion brilliantly mixed three very potent ingredients. First was therapy. This was right after the war. The country was still traumatized by the experience. Freudianism and existentialism were popular. We were living under the threat of universal extinction from a mushroom cloud. It was a time when therapy seemed to offer as much of an answer as religion did. The second ingredient was celebrity. Hubbard understood if there's one thing that Americans truly do worship, it's celebrity. And for that reason, he established the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles. And he created the Celebrity Center in Hollywood, where celebrities would come and feel at home and have their spiritual needs administered to. And also probably become spokespeople for the church, pitchmen like the athletes on the Wheaties boxes. Early on in the church's history, the church sent out a roster of people they thought would make good Scientologists, and they wanted other Scientologists to try to recruit them. And they were names like Bob Hope, Walt Disney, Marlena Dietrich, Howard Hughes. I mean, they're some of the most famous people in the world. And they said, if you bring one of these celebrities to us, you will be given a small plaque in recognition. Now, celebrities did come to the church. It wasn't, you know, like, you know, Rock Hudson came in for a while. I was told the reason he left is that he was in a counseling session and he wanted to go feed the parking meter and his counselor wouldn't let him. So he stormed out and never came back. People like Leonard Cohen, members of the Grateful Dead, Elvis Presley went in for, he got some books. I don't know if he ever got any auditing, but his widow and daughter are still prominent members. I mean, the church did draw in remarkable people. And they served the purpose that Hubbard had in mind. Scientology made a name for itself through exploiting celebrities. And the third potent ingredient in the Scientology recipe is science. Hubbard didn't like to call Scientology a religion. He built it as a technology, a step-by-step guaranteed process to spiritual enlightenment. And the centerpiece of his technology is the E-meter. The E-meter is two tin cans. In the old days, they were Campbell's soup cans with the label scraped off. And there's electrical wire that passes through them to a meter. And there's a small indetectable current that passes through. In the church, they say that it measures the mass of your thoughts. Well, there's no evidence that thoughts have mass. What we know that it measures is your galvanic skin response, especially how clammy your hands are. It's one-third of a lie detector. Now, the E-meter, according to Hubbard, sees just below the level of consciousness. In other words, in a way, it knows you better than you know yourself. It knows what you're going to think before you've thought it. So it's a very valuable, powerful instrument in his mind. In the middle 60s, fleeing indictments, Hubbard sought a safe place to avoid the process servers. So he took to the high seas. He created a Scientology Navy with himself as the Commodore in the flagship Apollo. And he called upon all these young Scientologists to serve as crew members, and they were called the Sea Organization, or Sea Org in Scientology terms. They are still the clergy inside the church. They still wear naval uniforms. Inside the Sea Org, there was a special group called Commodore's Messengers. And these were typically young teenage girls. In warmer climates, they wore halter tops, short shorts, and platform shoes. And they ministered to Hubbard. They put him to bed at night. They bathed him. They if he needed a cigarette, they would give him a cigarette and light it. If he started to sit down, a chair would appear. And if he had an order to give to the captain, for instance, he would yell out, "Messenger!" And one of the girls would come into his cabin, and he would tell her what to tell the captain in no uncertain terms. And she would go into the captain and bark out in his language, not missing any of the profanity he might have thrown in, and tell the captain what Hubbard said. And the captain would look at the little girl and say, "Yes, sir," because he knew he was talking directly to Hubbard through the Commodore's messenger. The relationship of Hubbard and these girls has been a matter of speculation. I have never found that he crossed a sexual line with them. But it's very intriguing and strange. I mean, they took care of him, and he parented them. Like when they were old enough to put on makeup, he taught them how to put on their makeup. It was a very... And some of these now elderly young women have very fond memories of those times. During that decade afloat, Hubbard elaborated the cosmology of Scientology, much of the story that I told you at the beginning. Scientology is really a journey inside the mind of L. Ron Hubbard, and it's a dangerous journey. Many former Scientologists I've spoken with have experienced nervous breakdowns and have had suicidal thoughts. It's also very expensive. You can expect to pay as much as $500,000 just for the coursework alone to reach the upper tier of Scientology, not to mention the counseling costs, the endless requests for donations for the building fund for galas, for Hubbard books and materials and tapes and new versions of the E-meter. Scientology is very adept at getting money out of its parishioners. According to former executives, it now has $1 billion in cash in offshore accounts. The Catholic Church would be hard-pressed to come up with $1 billion in liquid assets right now. So why would anyone believe this, much less pay for it? First of all, hope. This is the appeal of all great religions, isn't it? If you were to walk into say you went into that brand new Scientology building on 3rd Avenue, typical, beautiful restoration of a Scientology building, and they would greet you, and they would ask you, "What's ruining your life? What is your ruin? What's standing in the way of your fulfillment as a human being, personally, professionally, economically? Whatever it is, we can help you with that. We have a menu of courses." And people are helped by the courses they take in Scientology. It's, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, for instance, not a Scientologist. He credits a communication course he took at Scientology with giving him the courage to become a professional comedian. You'll also be offered auditing, the Scientology therapy. And this is how it works. If you go in and sit down and you're holding the cans, and across from you is the auditor, and the auditor will ask you questions, and maybe you seem a little agitated today. What's wrong? Well, I had a fight with my husband. Well, tell me about it, because the needle is moving. And so you tell the story, and tell the story again. So you tell the story again, and the needle is not quite as agitated as it was. And you may tell it four or five times. And eventually the emotional affect of that experience diminishes. This is not uncommon in other forms of therapy. But then the auditor will say, I want you to tell me an earlier similar. In other words, has this ever happened to you before? Well, yeah, my daddy scolded me just like that when I was a little girl. Okay, tell me about that, needle. And okay, discharge the emotions. And finally, what about something earlier? Well, that's it. I've gotten to the end of my life, the beginning of my life. Wait a minute. The needle just moved. What just went through your mind? I don't know. I had an image of a barn. Well, go back. Go back to that barn. Are you inside or outside? I'm inside. Open the door. What do you see? I don't know. It looks like France. What year is it? I don't know. 1742? The needle's telling you this is true. And this is good news. You've lived before. And look, we can prove it. Now, if you live before, you'll live again. This is hope that Scientology is able to provide. We can prove to you that you've had a prior existence. Another thing that's very common in auditing sessions is out-of-body experiences. This is what happened to John Travolta the very first time he got audited, when he was a troubled young man on his first movie set, and a fellow actor gave him some Scientology auditing. He suddenly had this sense of leaving his body. And the message that you have from that is that you are not your body. You are an eternal spirit. And that is good news. Another element that was very evident in the early days of Scientology, part of its appeal was play. There was a saying in the early days of Scientology, if it's not fun, it's not Scientology. And people recalling those times often talk about how many good times they had. Sitting around with Hubbard on the bow of the Apollo, and he's recalling his earlier past lives when he was a race car driver in the Mercabian civilization millions of years ago. On one occasion, for instance, he decided that he told everyone that he had been a Carthaginian sailor. And back in those days, he had a lot of money, and he used to go bury treasure around the Mediterranean. Let's go look for it. Let's go find that stuff. I know where it is. So he got a couple of smaller ships and took a select crew, and they went around to Sicily and different ports of call looking for his buried treasure, and they never found it. But they had a blast. And it was striking to me. I would ask them, you know, about these stories of his past lives. Where did those, you know, did anybody ever ask him where these ideas came from? And practically no one ever did. It reminded me a little bit, and I don't mean to be patronizing about this, but it reminded me a little bit of when my children were young and they had imaginary games. They did not want you to enter into it. You had to suspend a certain amount of disbelief, and it was hard for the parent or the adult to break into that barrier. I felt a little bit like that when I was talking to people about their playful period in Scientology. Another important factor in Scientology is purpose. For people who are seeking meaning in life, Scientology offers a high goal: to save the planet from its inevitable cycle of self-destruction. Now, in the process of doing this high calling, many people in Scientology have proved that they are willing to do almost anything in the name of the church. In the 1970s, there was something called Operation Snow White. Hubbard was anxious about what the government knew about Scientology and what they might do with that information. So under the direction of his wife, Mary Sue, 5,000 Scientologists infiltrated the government, the FBI, the Justice Department, the Food and Drug Administration, the IRS, and the Washington Post, the Better Business Bureau, and not just the American government, but Germans and so on. It was the largest domestic spying scheme in our history. And the FBI finally found out about it, and 11 people went to prison for it, including Mary Sue Hubbard. Another powerfully appealing feature of Scientology is community. Scientology beliefs are bizarre, but they're not the only religion that has esoteric beliefs. Religion itself, in some ways, is a belief in the irrational, which could also serve as a definition, couldn't it, of insanity. The only thing that separates a religion from the larger society is the wall of belief that they build around themselves. They're not separated by race or language or ethnicity. It's only the beliefs. In some cases, the stranger and the more bizarre the beliefs are, the higher the wall and the more enclosed and protected the community inside it seems to be. It's a lot easier to get into that community than it is to get out of it, however. And I've talked to hundreds of people who have been in Scientology, and many of them who've gotten out of it and have had the experience of having family members or loved ones disconnect from them. It's a process of being directed to cut off all communications with the very people that are closest to you and have your interests at heart. Another factor that's something that I think is very appealing and maybe a little harder to understand, but structure. Scientology is a totalistic community. All questions are answered. And it's especially true in the Sea Org. These are people that join the clergy, usually when they're very young. I mean, I've talked to people who join the Sea Org when they're 8 years old. Many children have joined the Sea Org, and when they do that, they sign a contract for 1 billion years of service. If life is eternal, 1 billion years is not such a big deal. And they forfeit their educations. They're paid $50 a week, so they're impoverished by their service, often sequestered, especially in this international headquarters that Sea Org has in a desert compound in Southern California called Gold Base. And if you have doubts about your religion or you want to leave, you may be put into a re-education camp called Rehabilitation Project Force. It's very much like the re-education camps in China under Mao, where your day is spent in criticism, self-criticism, reading the works of L. Ron Hubbard over and over again. And people are sometimes confined in these things for years on end. Now, there is one in particular, one of these rehabilitation project forces on the Gold Base. It's called The Hole. And in 2006, it was an office suite made up out of two double-wide trailers that had been married together. And that year, David Miscavige, the church's current leader and Hubbard's successor, cleared out all the furniture. And he began sending his top-tier executives into the hole for them to re-educate themselves. And it wasn't for like a weekend. When I was working on my story, the president of the church, a nominal post, was an elderly man named Heber Jinch, who'd been in there for 7 years. they were sleeping on sleeping bags on the floor, let out once a day to shower, eating oftentimes slop from buckets, a lot of physical abuse, a lot of degrading things. For instance, one executive was directed to mop the toilet floor with his tongue. That kind of thing was not unusual. And one night, David Miscavige came into the hole with a jambox. He's going to play some music. And he asked, does anybody here know what musical chairs is? And someone said, well, it's a game. It's a game where you have a circle of chairs. And people walk around the circle. And when the music stops, everybody sits down. But there's always one less chair than there are number of people. And so he started playing Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. Chairs had been brought in, and the upper-level Scientology executives began walking around the circle of chairs, and when the music stopped, they would sit down, and somebody would be thrown out. And Miscavige said that the last person still sitting would be able to stay. Everybody else, you're out of here. We'll send you, maybe to some far-flung Scientology outpost, or kick you out of the Sea Org. Husbands and wives will be separated. He actually had airline tickets printed up at the Scientology travel office to give reality to this. And as a number of chairs diminished, fights broke out. Clothes were torn. Chairs were broken. And what was so striking to me, they were fighting to stay. It was the world outside that frightened. Scientology, that's why one of the subtitles of this book is The Prison of Belief. It has a powerful grip on people's loyalty and their imagination. I hope I've answered some of the questions I've posed about where new religions come from and why people would believe them. I just want to address one other question. Is there a future for Scientology? L. Ron Hubbard died in 1986. And Scientology planned for a future without him. There are several places around the country where all of his works, all 1,000 titles, are buried in titanium canisters inside nuclear blast-resistant caverns filled with argon gas so that some future civilization may come and discover the works of L. Ron Hubbard. They've also planned for a future in which he returns. Every Scientology office in this new building down on 3rd Avenue, I'm sure, has an office for L. Ron Hubbard for when he returns. He has several residences where his cars are kept, all gassed up with the keys in the ignition. There's a table set for one. There's his Tom McCann sandals beside the shower and a Zane Grey novel on the bedside table. So Scientology sees a future for itself with or without L. Ron Hubbard. And there may be a future. If you look at the Mormons, still to this day, the most persecuted sect in our history, chased out of one state after another, its leader assassinated. In the last presidential election, you had a Mormon running for president, and it wasn't even really a serious issue. So that could happen to Scientology. It has a lot of money. It has a lot of lawyers. What it doesn't really have is any new members, is suffering in that department. So if Scientology wants to have a future, it has to have a reckoning with all the abuse and the misbehavior that's going on inside the church. And how could that happen? Well, there are only two ways that I can think of. One is that the IRS reconsiders its decision to award the church a tax exemption, which in 1993, whatever the merits of the case, the Scientologist had sued, it had filed 2,400 lawsuits against the IRS. They followed individual agents around with private investigators and wrote stories about agents that were cheating on their wives or having too much to drink at a convention or so on. And in that context, the IRS awarded the church's tax-exempt status that allowed it to exist today. I don't think it has the stomach to go back to that. The only other way I can imagine that Scientology might have an accounting inside itself is that some of these celebrities that they've been using to sell the church turn their megaphone around and ask for an accounting. And I particularly note Tom Cruise in that category. No individual has been as important to Scientology as Tom Cruise in modern times. And no one has benefited more individually. These Sea Org members that I've told you about, they built an airplane hangar for his plane collection. They handcrafted a limousine. They reconditioned his houses. All of these people are paid slave labor. And they were working for Tom Cruise, a very wealthy man. I think that he could do more to make a change inside the church than any other individual. But new religions will come along, whether Scientology exists or not. They always do, especially in America, where you can believe anything you want. And if you don't find a belief you like from the smorgasbord of beliefs that are laid out before you, you can create your own, just as L. Ron Hubbard did. Wherever people long to understand the meaning of existence, wherever they want to know how to express their adoration of the glory of life, whenever they seek solace for the grief that comes with loss and pain, whenever they try to pry open the mystery that death encloses, answers will arise. We call these answers religion. Perhaps it is a form of insanity or brainwashing, or at best a willful suspension of the rules of reality. We seem to be stuck with religion as a feature of the human condition. As Montaigne observed, man is certainly stark mad. He can't make a worm, but he invents gods by the dozen. Thank you very much.
So while the ushers are collecting your questions, we've got some that we took in through Facebook and through email before your
lecture.
The mothership of Scientology schools for brainwashing kids is here in Oregon, passing as a secular independent K-12 boarding school called the Delphinian Academy.
Yeah.
What do you think concerned Oregonians should do about it?
Well, it's a religiously chartered school, and I don't think you can do very much about it. There are a number of Scientology schools. They follow Hubbard's Scientology, his Hubbard's educational methods, and they are there are several principles. One is that if you can't understand something, it's probably because you don't know what the words mean. So you look everything up in the dictionary. Nothing wrong with that. Another thing is that if you want to learn what a tractor is, you should go look at a tractor. You can't learn about it as a word. But if you don't have a tractor ready, you should take clay and make a tractor, and that way you will learn what a tractor is. And it's easier to work with clay on when you're talking about tractors, but when you're talking about agriculture or plowing or something, it's a little more a difficult concept to put into clay. Some people have done well in Scientology education. Will Smith started a school that was Scientology based on educational methods that Hubbard developed. When I was writing about Paul Haggis, who was the centerpiece of my New Yorker profile that began my adventure into Scientology, I interviewed one of his daughters, and she said that she had grown up in Scientology school and she was illiterate until she was 11 years old. She couldn't write her name. But then she came to the Delphian Academy and she actually was helped. But she didn't graduate from high school till I think she was 20 years old.
Do you know what, if any, impact your book has had on Scientology?
There are two ways I can judge. One is by the legal threats that I've received. And if that's any evidence that I've stirred up the hornet's nest, yes, the hornets are buzzing. They haven't sued. That doesn't mean they won't. But, you know, there are many, many legal threats. The other thing is that I've innumerable people in situations just like this come up to me and tell me, I was in Scientology, or my sister or my son or somebody dear to me is in Scientology, and I haven't spoken to him in 12 years. And, you know, the amount of heartache that families have endured because of that is really hard to measure, but it seems very extensive.
Have you been changed spiritually as a result of your investigations into other people's beliefs?
Well, yeah, I always feel awkward explaining. I don't know why I got interested in religion. I imagine that, you know, part of it is that I was religious as a teenager. But I fell away from that. I was very engaged with a high school religious group. But I stepped away from that. But I think having been religious at one point made me sympathetic to people who do adhere to different religious beliefs, no matter what they might be. And it makes me understand, too, that religion is very powerful in people's lives. And a lot of times I don't think journalists appreciate that, you know, writing about religion has no status in journalism. It's like writing about cooking or something. But not there's anything wrong with either one, but in terms of the ranking order, religion has very low rank in the journalism fraternity. But you can hold very strong political beliefs, and it may not affect your behavior at all. But that's just not true with religious beliefs. If you have strong religious beliefs, they may well dominate your lives. And I've lived in many countries, especially in the Middle East, where you see religion being a far more formative and formidable influence on society than their political structures.
Can we switch to the Looming Tower a little bit? Because there's a bunch of questions here, too, about that. I have a question about the Looming Tower, which our book group is discussing this week. Would you consider additional chapters about the decision to go to war with Iraq and the whole and all that has led afterwards in the Middle East?
I don't know. I only recently got called back to duty on this when the judge, you know, you're familiar with the metadata controversy in the NSA's keeping records of every single phone call that all Americans make. And a judge in New York said that, in repeating what had been asserted by the head of the FBI and the former CIA agent and also the NSA head, if we had metadata, we could have stopped 9/11. Well, and the judge cited two hijackers that had made telephone calls to this place in Yemen. And if only the FBI had known about the fact that that they were in San Diego 21 months before 9/11, then we could have stopped 9/11. Well, yes, the FBI could have stopped 9/11 if the CIA had told them that Al-Qaeda was in America. The CIA knew it. They had followed them to Kuala Lumpur, where they had a meeting of Al-Qaeda chieftains who, you know, they went on to bomb the USS Cole that October in 2000, and then these two hijackers came to America, and the CIA knew it. And they did not tell the FBI about it. And it's one of the unexplained mysteries of 9/11. Why did the CIA, you know, they plead incompetence mainly, but it seems more likely to me that if Al-Qaeda comes to San Diego and starts making calls to this place in Yemen that we have a bug on, and that the CIA had some operation going, and they didn't want the FBI in on it. And alas, they didn't tell the FBI. And so metadata had nothing to do with that. And I'm kind of drawn to go back to that question about why, what did the CIA know and why did it not tell the FBI?
And following on that, I want there's a couple of questions in here. If you could talk a little bit about the Arab Spring.
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking spring for me. I used to live in Cairo, and I taught at the American University. And I remember making a speech. It was during the primaries when Obama and Hillary Clinton were running against each other, and I was taking a poll about, you know, who would you vote for, and of course they couldn't vote for anybody that they wanted to at that time. And one of the young women in the audience who was covered in hijab said, "What happened to us? Why didn't we ever advance as a culture?" And I said, I understood that question, because when I lived in Cairo, Egypt was like on the same level as South Korea, India, Singapore, you know, countries that have just exploded in wealth. And I said, I think it takes a generation. You know, my father was a part of that generation that went to World War II. And they created the greatest economic miracle ever seen. But it was not just one man or one individual, it was a whole generation. And there were generations there, you know, in South Korea and other places that were doing the same thing. I said, I think it's going to take a generation in Egypt. And I didn't realize then, but those were the same kids that were soon out in Tahrir Square trying to bring change to their country. And they did. They got Mubarak down. But they didn't follow through. That's the heartache. There were really two powers at work in Egypt that have been contending for power for decades, and that is the military, which really took effective control in 1952 and has never relinquished it, and the Muslim Brothers, which have been off and on an underground organization and is now going back underground. And that middle level, those promising kids, they were out in Tahrir. They have not been able to come to the fore. And I don't know when they can. I think the new order that's taking place in Egypt and elsewhere is much like the old order. And I think if I worry, but I feel that tyranny is going to recapture all those thrones of power in the Middle East. And it'll be a long time. I may not see it before democracy really comes to that region.
On a more general note, there's a question here which is, resonates with a few other questions. How do you keep your journalistic integrity while writing nonfiction? And what was the biggest challenge to your integrity in your career?
Well, you know, I think the way I would answer that is that the relationship between a reporter and a source is charged. It can feel like friendship. It's not. You have to keep that constantly in mind. And so when I'm interviewing someone that I like and I've spoken to many times and so on, I usually put a tape recorder in between us just so that we know that this is not the same thing as friendship. But, you know, it can feel, when you publish, like betrayal, because they don't have those same feelings. They feel like they were talking to someone who really understands them and agrees with them. And that's not, those two things are not the same. I always try, as a reporter, to do my very best not to judge somebody that I'm talking to right now. I want to see the world through their eyes. And that's a very powerful allure for people. People want to have their story told. I don't care if it's an Al-Qaeda terrorist or, you know, a candidate for city council. You know, people want someone to hear them, and they're looking for the empathic, understanding figure who can simply hear what they have to say. And I try to be that person. But then there is the process of separation. And that's where your integrity comes through, because your real obligation is to the reader to tell the truth.
We have time for one more question, and this is from one of the high school students, although it's not identified. It says from Madison High School. We know that. What are the literary books that you read in high school or around that time that had an impact on you and shaped your writing career?
You know, I was just thinking about that. I'm so blessed to be at the New Yorker, and I was a great fan of the New Yorker as a young man. And the people that this, especially John McPhee, he really impressed me, and I was particularly impressed with his structuralism, the way he could build a story. You know, an characteristic John McPhee story was his profiles of Arthur Ashe and Clark Grabner, two of the greatest tennis players of their generation. You know, one the son of a wealthy orthodontist and the other the son of a park maintenance guy who in black, you know, from Richmond. And they're playing a game. And the game is a part of the story. But as you go from set to set, you go back, you know, talk about Arthur's life, and then you go back to Clark's life. And it's a portrait of two Americas. This is a classic John McPhee structure. He once did a profile of Atlantic City using the Monopoly board as his the basic structure that underlay everything. And when I got into journalism, I thought that's the way you do it. And so one of the very first profiles I ever wrote was of a now forgotten baseball slugger named Dave Kingman, who played for the New York Mets. And his singular talent was he could hit a ball further than anybody had ever seen. He was constantly hitting them out of ballparks. And other than that, he wasn't a very distinguished player. But I wrote a profile of him using a game as a way of, you know, whenever he'd come up to bat, and, you know, and it was the skeleton on which I hung the profile. And my editor said, "This is great, just take the game out of it." And I said, "How do you do that? I mean, that it's like a, you know, it'll just fall to the floor, won't it?" And so I took the game out of it, and it worked. It was a profile. But I bring that up because I'm now doing a very John McPhee story, a book about Camp David, based on after my play that I've written. It's three chronologies. The 13 days that Camp David took place is one chronology, and underneath that is the history of the modern Middle East as seen through the eyes of the people who were at Camp David, Sadat, Moshe Dayan, Menachem Begin, like. And they really created the history that they were trying to solve. And then at bottom is the tectonic plate that moves all of this, which is the Old Testament. So this is my most McPhee-ish adventure. And it's still to be determined how it comes out. I'm going to my editor next week, and I'll get back to you on that. Well, thank you all. Yeah.
That was Lawrence Wright speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 2014. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us again for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.